Jennifer Staley is joining us today to train us on ICWA. She's an attorney and team supervisor at Kids Voice, which is an organization that represents children in the Pennsylvania dependency system. She's spoken to community leaders and at various conferences about issues relating to children, especially those issues that face children as they leave the foster care system. Ms. Staley serves on the Duquesne University Law School Alumni Association Board of Governors and has received awards for her work with at-risk adolescent boys. If everybody could please put their phone on mute, and all the materials that Ms. Staley is referencing throughout her call today will be available on the website. So, Jen, with that, I take it away.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everyone, for letting me have the opportunity to train on this issue. I'm going to walk through the purpose of ICWA, some of the definitions and the statute, and take you through notice and when does ICWA apply, and then all the way through to what's called an individual Indian monies account, where children would may be entitled to some monies if they're eligible for it under the ICWA statute. And I'm kind of going to throw in some practice tips of things I've learned from doing this and kind of having to learn on my own how this system works. So the purpose of ICWA was passed in 1978, and it does stand for the Indian Child Welfare Act. And the purpose of passing this act was due in part to the large number of Native American children that were being removed from their homes, both by public and private agencies. So the Indian Child Welfare Act was set up, and it was the constitutionality of the act was affirmed. And the case I've cited in the PowerPoint is the Mississippi Band of Chautauqua Indians versus Holyfield, and the site is available there on your PowerPoint. And basically it said held up that the Chautauqua tribe held exclusive jurisdiction over adoption proceedings were involving twin children whose parents were members of that tribe. There are several sources of law that one needs to review when looking at these cases. Obviously, there's federal statutes and there's the statute itself. There's BIA guidelines for state courts, and the BIA stands for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There's federal regulations and there's state statutes and case law. And I'm going to point out where things are relevant in Florida. The next thing I think that's most important is understanding the definitions within the ICWA statute itself. And I've gone through and defined each thing for you, and I won't necessarily read here, but an Indian child is a person who's under the age of 18 and is either a member of an Indian tribe or is eligible for membership in an Indian tribe and is the biological child of a member of an Indian tribe. An Indian is described as a member of an Indian tribe who is an Alaska Native and a member of a regional corporation. And then it defines Indian tribe. It also defines parent, which is the biological parent or parents of an Indian child, or Indian custodian, which is basically the legal custodian or the person who has legal custody of the Indian child. And I've typed out the exact definitions for each of you and cited where you can find them specifically in the statute. The next definition is an expert witness, and this is important in two areas of an ICWA case. An expert witness is going to be important where we're going to talk later about when you need to show that a child will continue to be in harm if they remain with the parents on the reservation, or in a termination case. If you are doing a contested termination, a parental rights case, you would need a qualified expert witness. Although it's not necessarily defined, the House report and the Bureau of Indian Affairs has set guidelines for state courts on what qualifies a person as an expert witness under the Indian Child Welfare Act. And those I've outlined here for you in the slides. One is that thing that should be considered is that it would be a member of the Indian Child's tribe who is recognized by that tribal community as knowledgeable in both tribal customs as they pertain not only to the organization but to child-rearing practices within that tribe. It can be a lay expert witness having substantial experience in the delivery of child service and family services to Indians and extensive knowledge of the prevailing social and cultural standards and child-rearing practices within the Indian Child's tribe. So it really should be a person who has the expertise not in ICWA itself, so it's not a person who's an expert in the ICWA statute and how that's applied, but it's a person who's an expert in the tribe that the child has identified with. The next definition is defined as extended family members, and basically that pertains to grandparents, aunt, uncle, brothers, or sisters, and some of these definitions are common sense. One of the definitions we talked about is defining an Indian child, and to determine if a person is eligible for membership in a tribe if they have not already established that membership, there is a website they can go to. It's www.accessgenealogy.com, and that should be on your presentation. They can go back all the way to great-great-great-grandparents. Beyond that, there would not be enough bloodline to be eligible for membership in the tribe. They would need to know the full name, address, telephone number, and a birth and a marriage certificate, if applicable, for themselves, their parents, and their grandparents. They would need to know the name of the tribe, and they would be able to fill that information out to determine if they are eligible. And ICWA applies to Indian children who are members of, who are eligible for membership in a federally recognized Indian tribe. So first you'd have to determine that, in fact, the child is eligible for membership in a tribe. And then you'd have to determine, is that tribe federally recognized? In Florida, there are two federally recognized tribes. They are the Seminole Tribe of Florida, and I'm going to spell this so I don't pronounce it wrong, the MICCOSUKEE Tribe of Indians of Florida. You can receive a list of federally recognized tribes at www.indians.org. And just as a practice note here, in a recent case I had in Pennsylvania, a mother did claim that she was a member of a tribe. The Child Services Agency did send notice to the tribe, and the tribe wrote back a letter saying that they would have liked to intervene, but they are not federally recognized, therefore they would have no standing, as ICWA would not apply. So it is important to make sure that the tribe that the parent or child may be claiming to be part of is federally recognized. The statute for ICWA only would apply to proceedings for foster care placement, voluntary and involuntary termination of parental rights, or pre-adoptive placement. Should point out, it does not apply to child custody proceedings that are pursuant to a divorce, and it does not apply to delinquency proceedings. And I've cited where you can find that information in the statute. It's unclear whether or not ICWA would apply to a step-parent adoption or to a third-party custody dispute. The Act is silent on that, and there's no case law in Pennsylvania that addresses that, or in Florida that I could find. The burden of proof is on the person who is asserting the applicability of ICWA. So it's up to the person who's saying that ICWA applies to prove that, in fact, it does. So if you've determined that the child is a member of a federally recognized tribe, throughout this, I'm going to use an example of a case I had where the child was a member of an Ute tribe in Colorado. His father was a member, and therefore he was eligible for membership and had been signed up by his family and was on the rolls of the tribe. When that situation happens, you need to look at jurisdiction. Who has jurisdiction? Is it the state court or is it the tribal court? And the first question is the child already a member of, already a ward of the tribal court, the child residing or domiciled within the reservation of the Indian tribe? If the answer is yes to those two questions, or one of those two questions, then the child, the Indian court has exclusive jurisdiction. On your website, it's going to be a flow chart that walks you through this jurisdiction issue. But basically, again, you're going to ask yourself, is the child domiciled on the reservation, or is the child already a ward of the tribal court? If that is the case, then the tribal court has exclusive jurisdiction of the child, and the state court would not have any jurisdiction. How do you determine domicile? It's based upon the physical presence with the intent to remain, and is generally that of the apparent. And again, in the Holyfield case, they describe domicile and define it. Domicile should be established as soon as possible. Here in Pennsylvania, we do not have any federally recognized tribes, but as I indicated in Florida, you have two, so you would want to determine, was the child living on the reservation at the time the state took custody, and was the child, or is the child already a ward of the tribal court? If the child does not fit one of the definitions for exclusive jurisdiction, then basically the state court and the tribal court have concurrent jurisdiction over any type of proceedings for child welfare cases or termination proceedings. If the child is eligible for more than one tribe, then it will be the tribe where the contact is greater, and that is for the state court to determine. So, for example, if the child is eligible for two separate tribes, and they do not fit the exclusive jurisdiction definition, but would fit the concurrent jurisdiction definition, the state court would determine where the contact is greater, and that would be the tribe that they would have concurrent jurisdiction with. There is an exception in the ICWA where if a parent is, if there's imminent physical damage or harm to the child, then the child, the state court can step in and intervene. There has to be a hearing held immediately to determine if that imminent physical damage or harm to the child, what it is. It's by clear and convincing evidence, and you would need an expert witness to determine that, in fact, there would be ongoing imminent physical damage or harm to the child. If the state cannot prove that, then the child must be immediately returned to the tribe in an exclusive jurisdiction case. And on the slides, I provided where you can find that in the statute. The BIA, or the Bureau of Indian Affairs, has set a practice tip-up, or a best practice standard, that the attorney for the child, if determined that the child would still be in imminent harm or risk if returned to the back to the reservation, that an affidavit should be filed with the court immediately to basically reiterate why the placement is needed to prevent the harm, and that the tribe should not take immediate jurisdiction. And if the state does not file, and in Pennsylvania we call them petitions for dependency, then the child has to be immediately returned if they can't meet that standard. There's also, if there's not exclusive jurisdiction, the tribe can ask for jurisdiction to be transferred to them. So, for example, again, if the child does not meet the definition for exclusive jurisdiction, meaning they don't live on the reservation or they were not a ward of the tribal court when the state got involved, then they can come in and ask for transfer of jurisdiction. Basically, they would file asking that the case be transferred to the tribal court. In that case, the court should transfer it unless they can show good cause as to why the case should not be transferred, or if a parent objects. There is not an exact definition of good cause. There are some factors that should be considered, and these are again set out by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Was it the request untimely? Did they ask for transfer maybe, you know, a year into a case? Is it an inconvenient forum? I think the most relevant is the transfer not in the child's best interest. As the child had minimal contact with the tribe, is this a child who's never had any contact with the tribe or any of its members? Is the child over 12 and object, or is the child over 5 and has had no contact with their parents or their tribe? Those are all things that should be considered when trying to determine if, in fact, a case should be transferred. In my example of the client here, the Ute tribe in Colorado did file a petition to transfer jurisdiction to the tribal court in Colorado. It was denied by our court based on the fact that the child was here in a home with three other siblings and had had no contact with his father, had never had any contact with any of the Ute tribe members in Colorado, had never been to Colorado and was 5 years old and had no contact with anybody. And even once the tribe came here and saw that, determined it wasn't in this child's best interest to be taken out of his environment and removed from his siblings and taken to Colorado. So that's just a practical example. The right to intervene is different from the right to the motion to transfer, and a tribe has a right to intervene at any step of the proceeding. So it doesn't necessarily just have to be when the child initially comes to the attention of the court. It can be throughout the proceeding, whether that be at termination stage, whether that be at a permanency foster care review a year down the road. And this, again, is different from the right, from the motion to transfer. It's very important to make sure that you, if you have determined that a child is a member of a tribe or is eligible for membership, that notice requirements be followed. It's not going to help any child if a child's been in care and you're getting to termination and all of a sudden it's realized that that piece was missed. And then now all of a sudden you have to notify the tribe once termination hearing is about to begin, because that will just complicate matters, and it really should be dealt with at the beginning. In a voluntary proceeding where the state court knows or has reason to know that an Indian child is involved, the party seeking the foster care placement of or termination of parental rights to the Indian child shall notify the parent or the Indian custodian in the Indian child's tribe. That's the definition under the notice. What I want to point out here is that this needs to be done by registered mail with return receipt. It also needs, in that letter, it needs to state that the tribe has a right to intervene, and it must be received 10 days before the hearing. And the parent or the Indian tribe does have a right to request a 20-day continuance. Sometimes you'll have parents who may say, I think I'm a member of an Indian tribe, I think my grandmother was, I think my child's registered. They may name three different tribes. So in that situation, if it's not, can't be determined exactly what tribe it is, or you can't determine the identity or the location of the tribe, notice shall be given to the Secretary of the Interior, who should have 15 days after the receipt of the letter to request notice to the other tribe. So they will look into what tribes are possibly eligible, where this child would possibly be eligible for membership. They will notify all those tribes, and then they need 15 days to complete that to determine if, in fact, the child is. In my first case example, the mother didn't know exactly what tribe. Three letters were sent, and as I said, one tribe did respond but was not federally recognized. Therefore, ICWA did not apply. The Indian custodian or the tribe in that situation also can be granted 20 additional days to prepare for the proceeding. So if they've been notified by the Secretary of the Interior, they determine that the child is eligible, they are federally recognized, and they have a right to intervene, ask for a motion to transfer, may possibly have exclusive jurisdiction, any of those things are possible, they can ask for 20 days, additional days to prepare for the proceeding. Who must receive notice? The parent, the Indian custodian, the Indian child's tribe, and again, if you don't know who the Indian child's tribe is, the Secretary of the Interior and the Area Director for the Bureau of Indian Affairs will need to be sent notice. On your website are going to be sample letters of what needs to be identified in the letters and to be sent out to those specific to all those specific people. In Pennsylvania, those letters are sent out by our Department of Human Services and Children and Youth Workers. But I did provide you with some samples. Also on your website is going to be the phone number, address, fax number for the person who is the Bureau of Indian Affairs Director for the Florida region. Also under ICWA, just another important note, is that parents must be notified of the right to appointed counsel, or if they are indigent, so they do have a right to have counsel. They do also have a right to examine reports or other documents filed with the court pertaining to the ICWA proceedings. So just a summarized notice, it must be sent registered mail return receipt. Proof of notice should be filed with the court. Notice must be received 10 days prior to the hearing. And the parent or Indian custodian can request a 20-day continuance. If you are don't know the child's tribe and it's being sent to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Secretary of the Interior, you need 15 days prior to the hearing to provide notice to the tribe. They must be notified of all proceedings. So just because once you've sent notice and the tribe has identified themselves, you have to continue to notify them of all proceedings through, if in fact it does get to termination. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs does have guidelines of what should be put in the letters, but I also, as I indicated, there'll be sample letters provided on your website. Any agency who is seeking to place a child in foster care or to terminate their parental rights to an Indian child has to satisfy under ICWA what's called active efforts. This can be looked at in the same way as reasonable efforts is looked at under ASFA, but basically saying that the agency has provided remedial services and rehabilitative programs designed to prevent the breakup of the Indian family, and that these efforts have proved unsuccessful. Active efforts is not defined, but it is something to keep in mind. No foster, and we'll address that again as I get to terminations. No foster care placement may be ordered in such proceeding in the absence of a determination supported by clear and convincing evidence, including that of a qualified child expert witness, that the continued custody of the child by the parent or Indian custodian is likely to result in serious emotional physical damage to the child. So that is where we talked about when the court would have exclusive, or the tribal court would have exclusive jurisdiction. You have to show by clear and convincing evidence why that child should not be returned to the tribal court. I've listed here some factors to consider at a shelter hearing, and these have also are available through the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. Basically, you want to look at, is the child under 18, unmarried, and a member of a federally recognized tribe? And by, I should probably qualify, by shelter hearing, I mean an emergency hearing. This would be the child's first contact with the court when they're initially being removed, and there's that emergency hearing. Are they eligible for membership in a federally recognized Indian tribe? And is the biological child of a member of a federally recognized tribe? Was the child in the custody of an Indian custodian prior to the hearing? If the Indian child is residing or domiciled on an Indian reservation, or is the child already a ward of the tribal court? Is the child reside or domiciled on a reservation but is temporarily off the reservation? The court may order an emergency removal from the parent or Indian custodian to prevent imminent physical damage or harm to the child. So these are all questions to be asked when a child is initially coming in to into the system. Was there proper notice given? Was it sent certified? Was it sent registered mail return receipt? Were inquiries mailed to all tribes in which the child may be eligible for membership? Oftentimes, it's helpful to include a family chart or a genogram to facilitate the tribe's membership determination, and there'll be a sample one that our Department of Human Services uses available on your website. If the child's tribe is not known at this time, was written notice sent to the U.S. Secretary of the Interior, and was it sent within the reasonable time frame? Remember, they need to have 15 days from the receipt to get notice out to the other to all the tribes. Has the agency made efforts to place the child with extended family or other tribal members or other Indian families? And is the parent able to understand their proceedings? Have they been provided counsel? At the shelter hearing, it's also important to make sure that the agency is mailing notice of the next scheduled hearing, a copy of the petition, and by that I mean once a child initially comes into care and then the agency is going to file a petition for dependency, they need to be sent a copy of that petition. They also should be sent advice of rights under ICWA to the parent and the Indian custodian, as well as to the tribe. And again, this all must be sent registered mail with return receipt. Under ICWA, once there are placement priorities, so if a child is removed and placed into foster care, you've gone through all your questions to yourself about things that should be considered at a shelter hearing, there should be placement priorities. A member of the Indian child's extended family should be looked at first. A foster home licensed, approved, or specified by the Indian child's tribe. An Indian foster home licensed or approved by an authorized non-Indian licensing authority, or an institution for children approved by an Indian tribe or operated by an organization which has a program suitable to meet the Indian child's needs. In Florida, there is a website that you can go to, and it's NICWA.org, and there's a Florida fact sheet, and this will be linked on your website. You'll be able to link to this, and it does provide you with the organizations within Florida that do have foster care placements for Indian children that you can contact, as well as the tribal and contact information for the two federally recognized tribes within Florida, as well as your regional director for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And it provides you with their websites, phone numbers, fax numbers, and all that will be available on your website. Considerations at a petition hearing. So the petition hearing being now the state has filed their petition asking that the child be adjudicated dependent. These are considerations that should be made regarding the child in ICWA. Has it been established that the child is an Indian child under the under ICWA? Does the state court lack jurisdiction because the child is already a ward of the tribal court? Have you determined where was the child domiciled at the time of removal? Is there exclusive jurisdiction with the tribal court, or is it concurrent jurisdiction with the tribal court? Is there a legal basis for the court or the state to intervene? Did the agency try and provide any remedial services or rehabilitative programs to prevent the breakup of the family? And the court must also make specific findings, including whether the child is an Indian child under ICWA, specify the efforts made to identify the tribe, and ensure proper notice was sent to all tribes and the secretary. As I had indicated in my first case example, where the mother did indicate three different tribes that the child possibly could be a member for, the agency sent out the letters with all proper notice, and one tribe did write back indicating that the grandmother was a member and that the child would be a member, but they are not federally recognized. So at our petition hearing, that letter was admitted into evidence, and our judge made a finding that the child was dependent, but also that the Indian Child Welfare Act did not apply because the tribe in which the child was eligible for was not federally recognized. That is now important 2.5 years later because we are going to termination now for that child, and that it's important that we establish that within the dependency proceeding that ICWA did not apply, so we don't have to deal with that now at the termination stage of the case. So if you can get your court to make a finding of whether or not ICWA applies, I think it can help down the road. You should specify, is the child already a ward of the tribal court? Was the child in the custody of an Indian custodian at the time of removal? Something to consider. Again, making sure all proper notice was sent to a tribe or the Indian custodian. Ascertain if the tribe seeks to intervene and grant the request if more than one tribe is trying to intervene. Which tribe will be identified for ICWA purposes. So again, that's where you're going to look at what contact, where does the child have the greatest contact with which tribe. And if the tribe, parent, or Indian custodian requests that additional 20 days to prepare for the hearing, this should be granted to ensure that, in fact, that it is. If the court declines to transfer the case, they should specify why. They should specify whether it's because the parents objected, whether it's because the tribe declined to accept jurisdiction. The tribe does not have to take jurisdiction when there's concurrent jurisdiction. They may not have the resources, may not want to intervene, may not have any reason to think that the child should come and live on the reservation. Or was it because of good cause? And they should state what that good cause was. As I previously indicated, there is no set definition of good cause, but some examples to look at is, is the child over 12 and they object? Is it not in the best interest of the child to be transferred? And always, again, remember at the petition stage, again, the parents should be provided with a lawyer if they cannot afford one. So once you've determined you've had your considerations for the shelter hearing, you've had your considerations for the petition hearing, if in fact it gets that far, then there's considerations that should be looked at in terms of disposition. If the agency is recommending foster care, there should be an affidavit presented by the agency documenting what active efforts they took. It should include description of the efforts made to keep the family together, the efforts to find a placement within the Indian community, visits with extended family or other tribal members, the agency's plan to coordinate with the child's tribe and family to identify significant cultural events and arrange for child attendance. And these considerations should continue during all permanency review hearings or foster care review hearings. In Pennsylvania, as I indicated, we have one foster care agency that does just take mostly Native American children in, and it has been identified. And as I indicated, in Florida, at that website, www.nicwa.org, which will be available on your website, they do give you the list of some agencies that can fulfill trying to find a home that would meet some of these considerations of disposition, as well as provide cultural events and keep the child in touch with their community. The tribe should continue to be notified at all subsequent hearings via registered mail return receipt. And the agency should continue efforts to locate extended family. So the agency should continue to follow the placement guidelines that are set forth under ICWA, the priority placement guidelines. The next part to consider or to look at in the Indian Child Welfare Act is under termination of parental rights. The important thing to point out here is that, as we talked about before, in a shelter hearing, in a petition hearing, a disposition, everything is by the standard of burden of proof is by clear and convincing evidence. Once you get to termination of parental rights, if it does apply under ICWA and it's a contested hearing, then the burden of proof must be supported by evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, and it must include the testimony of a qualified expert witness. And again, qualified expert witness has not been exactly defined by statute, but there are guidelines that have been set out by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in that, again, it should not be someone who's an expert in ICWA, but someone who is an expert in the tribe in which the child has been identified with. And basically, they also need to show that the continued custody of the child by the parent or Indian custodian is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. So I have cited on the slides where you can find that in the statute. If the termination is voluntary, meaning the mother has determined that she would like to give up the child voluntarily, any consent given prior to or within 10 days of the birth of the Indian child shall not be valid. It will only be valid if it's executed in writing and recorded before a judge of a court of competent jurisdiction, and accompanied by a certificate that it illustrates the terms and consequences of the consent were explained in detail and understood. It may be withdrawn at any time prior to the entry of the final decree of termination or adoption, and at that time the child would be returned to the parent.
Sure, they've got a distinction. I'm not sure they have.
Make sure notice was sent to the tribe by registered mail return receipt. Notice needs to be provided to the parent or the Indian custodian by registered mail. You need to make sure that active efforts were put in place by the agency. Again, as I indicated previously, active efforts has not been defined, but it does say it's remedial services and rehabilitative programs designed to prevent the breakup of the family. So under ASFA, as I'm sure you're all aware, there is a section of where you can make a finding of aggravated circumstances. And when a court does make a finding of aggravated circumstances based on one of the, whatever the agency is alleging, whether it be abandonment, aggravated sexual assault, or something of that nature, the agency can be relieved of providing what we call reasonable efforts. There are only two states that I could find and that have dealt with what trumps. Does ICWA trump or does ASFA trump? The two states have dealt with that so far are South Dakota, and South Dakota has said that ICWA trumps ASFA, and Alaska, and in Alaska their courts have said ASFA trumps ICWA. So those are the two that have addressed the conflict of whether or not an agency can be relieved of this reasonable efforts requirement or active efforts requirement. You also need to remember that the evidence has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, including the testimony of the expert witness, and that the continued custody of the child by the parent or Indian custodian is likely to result in a serious emotional or physical damage to the child. After the entry of a final decree of adoption of an Indian child in any state court, as we said before, the parent may withdraw consent upon the grounds that the consent was obtained through fraud or duress, and then may petition the court to vacate such decree. Under these circumstances, this can happen where the adoption has occurred in 2 years or less. The adoption would have had to have happened with 2 years or less, and they would have to prove that it happened under fraud or duress. in order to have it vacated. And if it is vacated, the child should be returned to the parent or the Indian custodian.
What a ruse.
There are adoptive placement preferences, which are basically the same as placement preferences for foster care. It should be a member of the child's extended family if possible, other Indian families, other members of the Indian child's tribe, a foster home licensed, approved, or specified by the Indian child's tribe, an Indian foster home licensed or approved by an authorized non-Indian licensing attorney, or an institution for children approved by an Indian tribe or operated by an Indian organization that can meet the Indian child's needs. And again, that information of those organizations will be on your website. The tribe does have the right to establish a different preference by resolution, the preference of order. If they do establish a different order of preference, make sure that we still would want to look to make sure it's the least restrictive placement for the child. The other thing that is interesting is rights to information after adoption. Upon application by an Indian individual who has reached the age of 18 and who was the subject of an adoptive placement, the court which entered the final decree shall inform such individual of the tribal affiliation, if any, of the individual's biological parents, and provide such other information as may be necessary to protect any rights flowing from the individual's tribal relationship. So, in Pennsylvania, that's a big deal because adoptions are sealed here. So after 18, the child would have then considered an adult, would have the ability to find out information about their biological family. Next thing I want to go over is sort of what is the role of the guardian ad litem. I should point out in Pennsylvania we do things a bit differently than in Florida. In Pennsylvania, all children are appointed a guardian ad litem in every case. All children have an attorney who represents the child in every single case from the beginning of the proceeding all the way through whenever the case closes, whether that would be adoption, reunification, or a permanent legal custody. And we always, for the most part, act in the role of guardian ad litem. Sometimes we act as a true attorney client in certain situations, but a child should be appointed a GAL in all ICWA cases, and the GAL should be present at all stages of the proceedings. As I've already indicated, in Pennsylvania, that's automatic. But if your jurisdiction does not automatically appoint a GAL to children, then one should be appointed in all ICWA cases. And the GAL should represent the child. The GAL should ensure that the agency and the court are following all of the proper guidelines. So a lot of the things that I have gone through, like sending letters, notice, determining whether the child may identify with, speaking to the parents, a lot of that should be conducted by your local DHS office. But as the guardian ad litem, you would want to ensure that these things are happening properly. So you'd want to ensure that the notice is being sent, that the agency has made the efforts to find if the child does identify with the tribe, that notice was sent properly. If you have reason to suspect, that the child is Native American, that maybe you're contacting the agency and making sure that these things are taking place properly, because so that we're not finding out down the line that this wasn't taken care of from the beginning, and also making sure that if the client is placed outside of their Native American community, that they do have connections to their culture. The other thing that is also important is, children are often entitled to individual Indian monies or IIM accounts. These IIM accounts are managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I'm going to briefly go over this. This is a very bureaucratic system, and there's right now massive litigation going on, class action suits against the federal government for the mismanagement of this money. But there's millions and millions of dollars that are available and that are being held in these accounts, but it hasn't been managed very well by the federal government. So as I said, lots of different class action lawsuits going on. But what it can be important in terms of representing children and how these IIM accounts would apply to them is that they may be entitled to per capita monies from their tribe. And from the example I've been using throughout this, while I've been speaking with you, is a client I had who was 5 years old, and as I said, the Ute tribe was going to take him, but then determined that it was not in his best interest. They remained active throughout the case. They were notified of all hearings and were notified of the termination hearing, which ended up being an uncontested termination hearing, as well as they were notified of the adoption. That client's father had passed away, and as a result, he inherited not only his own IIM account, but his account of his father. And the father's family had some land that they owned in Colorado. So, and this was, I think, three or four years ago, he had an IIM account that was worth $16,880, and he was receiving recurring income every year for $4,700 from oil and gas and $900 from grazing rights. So this money is being held for him in an IIM account, which he can ask for distribution, which I'm going to go through what those requirements are, or wait until he's 18 and get the distribution then. And this was money that he probably wouldn't have had any idea, you know, had he not, the tribe not intervened. I mean, he had, never had any contact with his father. He was five, and mom was nowhere to be found. But now this will be a nice a chunk of money for him as he moves forward in his life. These monies came when the federal government broke up land, and much of that land was rich in oil and timber. And the profit from the land is basically held in these IIM accounts. There are thousands of individual accounts that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is managing. There is a there's what's called a minor distribution plan, and I'm going to go through what that is. Basically, if the client does have access to an individual Indian monies account, they may be able to get a distribution while they're a minor. That is governed by the statute 25 CFR 115.420, and that's on the slide. There must be certain information that needs to be considered when looking at whether or not a minor's distribution plan distribution would be approved. Basically, you have to establish documentation of who has physical custody of the minor, a copy of any custodial orders or guardianships from a court of competent jurisdiction, the name of the person and his or her relationship to the minor who is making the request for the disbursement, an evaluation of other resources, what's the parent's income that may be available to meet the minor's needs, the list of what the amount is that you're seeking and what the purpose for that disbursement will be for, the name of the person to whom the disbursement may be made, so it could be the custodial parent, the legal guardian, people who have been recognized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs as having control and custody of the minor, or an emancipated minor, or any third parties to whom the Bureau of Indian Affairs would make a payment for goods or services to a third party, so if it's supported by an invoice or a bill of sale, so maybe it's for education, for educational purposes. The date when the person took care or control of the minor. If it's an emancipated minor, they must provide receipts to the BIA to show that the expenditures were made in accordance with the approved distribution plan. And then there's also a catch-all that any requirements and justifications for those requirements as necessary to ensure that any distribution will benefit the minor. There has to be the date that the disbursement plan was developed, approved, and reviewed, and it will be continued to be reviewed. So let's say, for example, it's for educational purposes. There might be a reason, a very valid reason, why a child cannot go to the public education system. They need a specialized school for whatever reason. You know, it can't be paid for through the public school system. So this plan, this is an ongoing thing. This child's going to be in school for several years. The disbursement plan will continue to be reviewed and to see if it's appropriate and any amendments that may be necessary. There has to be a signature of the BIA official approving the plan, and that the certificate that the plan is in the best interest of the account holder, as well as a signature of the custodial parent and legal guardian certifying that he or she has been consulted and has agreed to the terms of the evaluation and the distribution plan. There is also the statute that basically indicates what portion of the minor's funds may be withdrawn, and that's 25 CFR 115.417. And basically it points out that there has to be receipts for everything, for the any type of fund that you're asking to withdraw. And allowable uses include health care, education, or welfare when based upon a justified unmet need. So again, like I, with the example of the public school, you're going to have to prove why the public school system can't meet the child's needs, or maybe it's a health care issue where insurance is not going to cover some type of treatment that the child may need, et cetera, and that they would have access to a disbursement plan under this. It's also very important if your client is a member of an Indian tribe, that their name remains current on the rolls of the tribe as well as with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That if they move foster care agencies, if they move to a different home, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is always kept up to date of where they are. This is also important with a child who has been adopted to make sure that the, both the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the tribe are aware if the child's name has changed through the adoption, that they know where the child's living. You need to make sure that all of that is taken care of. They won't be able to get any information, or the Bureau of Indian Affairs won't be able to identify with them if this information is not kept updated within their databases. There's also a website, www.narf.org, that does walk through the individual Indian money accounts and provide some more information with also a list of frequently asked questions. The last slide gives you some helpful context. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is governed in Florida by the Eastern Region, and the contact for your region is Franklin Keel, and their phone number is there. That also will be available on your website. The attorney for the Bureau for the Department of the Interior Office of the Solicitor, the address, phone number, and fax number is there, and they are extremely helpful when trying to navigate the system and trying to find out if your client may be eligible for especially individual Indian monies, or if your client's being adopted, that making sure that the information stays accurate with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Another website that's very helpful, and again, this will be linked on your website, is www.nicwa.org. They provide great information. They also provide a list of scholarships that would be available to Native American children as they would, if they were looking to go on to college, and they link to about 5 or 6 different websites. I've listed those websites in the slide presentation as well, that all offer specific resources for Native American children who are planning to attend college. So that would be another avenue for your clients, for clients who are aging out of the foster care system, that they may be able to benefit from. So that's the general overview of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Again, your website's going to have the slide presentation, the sample letters, and all of the phone numbers, websites, fax numbers, addresses, and every contact you would need, both locally in Florida as well as at the federal level through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I guess if there's any general questions, I can answer them, or if you want, you can email me a question at jstaley@kidsvoice.org, and I would be happy to try and answer it.
Thank you so much for the presentation, and I think all of the resources that you're providing for us are great, too. So thank you very much, and thank you, everybody, for attending.